Let's go ahead and open our Bibles to Numbers chapter 30 as we do our verse-by-verse study today. Moses is coming closer and closer to the end of his ministry. We're in the tail end of the 40th year of the Exodus, and things are getting wrapped up. And so Moses has been passing on God's commands for how to worship through the year. In particular, the days of special sacrifices and days that are to be taken off of work, high holy days, things of that nature. And now Moses reminds the people that when you take your vows, there are some exceptions to following through with these vows made in the name of the Lord. And here are those exceptions. Numbers chapter 30, verse 1. Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the people of Israel, saying, "This is what he who is has commanded. If a man vows a vow to he who is, or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word." Now in the New Testament, Jesus, and then later, following Jesus' lead, his half-brother James, says that in the New Covenant, we should not be swearing oaths at all. And the reason was because they were manipulating the situation. They were using loopholes and other mechanisms to only keep the things they wanted to keep and to evade the things they didn't want to do anymore. Well, here is a reminder that when you do make a promise to the Lord, you're supposed to follow through with it. Again, in the New Testament, your yes should mean yes, and your no should mean no. Your word should be your bond. If you say you will do it, you need to do it. And you need to do it in the way you said you will do it. That's just being a person of character, being a person of integrity. So that's actually what we're seeing here in this verse, is that if you say you're going to do something, binding yourself under the name of he who is, you should follow through with it. Verse 2 continues, "He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." Verse 3, "If a woman vows a vow to he who is and binds herself by a pledge while within her father's house in her youth." Now this is where the first of the exceptions come. When a woman is minority age, or she is unmarried and still living under her father's roof, her father is the person accountable to God for everything done in his house. And so if his daughter makes a vow to God, he has veto authority over that vow. And so this is what it says. If her father hears of her vow and of her pledge by which she has bound herself and says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand and every pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand. So if he does not object, that means she is accountable for what she has said. If he says, "No, daughter, I don't think you should be making a promise like that. I veto it. I do not permit it." Then because he's the head of the household and there's this dispute between the two of them, he effectively outranks her when it comes to matters like this. And so she is not held accountable for making that promise. Verse 5, "If her father opposes her on the day that he hears of it, no vow of hers, no pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand, and he who is shall forgive her because her father opposed her." So it's a matter of accountability within the household. That brings us to exception number two, which is if she marries a husband while her vows or any thoughtless utterance of her lips by which she has bound herself, and her husband hears of it and says nothing to her on the day that he hears, then her vows shall stand and her pledges by which she has bound herself shall stand. So I've talked about this before, particularly from New Testament passages, that from the book of Genesis and what went on in the garden, chaos entered into the world. And chaos has to be met with some sort of organization. And so the husband-wife relationship is the smallest unit of society. And if there is a disagreement within that unit, because of what happened in the Garden of Eden, where the woman was deceived, as the text says, and the husband basically threw her under the bus and blamed her for his own choice. Because of those choices, from then on, in any marriage, the husband is accountable for everything that is decided to be done in the household. If he makes a choice on his own, after having talked with his wife about it, and they might disagree, but he says, I want us to go with what I say. And it blows up in his face, it's his fault. If he discusses things with his wife and he says, you know what, honey, I like your idea better, let's go with it. And it blows up in his face, it's not his wife's fault, it's his fault. And it's all related to what happened in the Garden of Eden. No husband can ever say, it was that woman that you gave to me that made me do this. That's off the table now, gentlemen. You do not have the option of throwing your wife under the bus ever again because of what Adam did. So the same thing is being applied here, is that now that you've got this partnership, a husband and a wife, and the wife makes some sort of vow on her own, and the husband hears what the vow is, and he says, I'm good with that. Or he doesn't say anything at all, which silence is assent. It's agreement. Then the oath is binding on her. She made the choice. She has to keep it. But, verse 8, if on the day that her husband comes to hear of it, he opposes her, then he makes void her vow that was on her, and the thoughtless utterance of her lips by which she bound herself, and he who is will forgive her. Now, don't get distracted by this thoughtless thing. It's one possibility that might be the case here, that she just says something really quick out of the blue without thinking it through, and the husband goes, wait a second, I don't think you really mean that. So let's not make that binding. So the husband can, as the head of the household, take accountability for that and say, no, God's not going to keep you accountable for your choice just now because I object. Now that's a father who is responsible for minors and those living under his roof, and a husband who is ultimately accountable to God for everything that happens between himself and his wife and his kids. So those are the two exceptions to an oath taken by a woman as to whether or not it needs to be followed through. Otherwise, in all other circumstances, it needs to be followed through. Because here are two more examples of where a woman is completely independent and what she says goes. Verse number 9, any vow of a widow, so her husband has passed away. So she is now the head of the household because she's the only one there. So anything that she promises to God has to be followed through with. Or of a divorced woman. It doesn't matter whether her husband divorced her or she divorced her husband or what even the reason was. She is now single again. which means she is accountable to God for anything that she promises. So verse 9 finishes, anything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. So the only exceptions have to do with somebody that's in a relationship where somebody else is accountable to God for what's going on in the household. Verse number 10. And if she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by a pledge with an oath, and her husband heard of it and said nothing to her and didn't oppose her, then all her vows shall stand. Every pledge by which she bound herself shall stand. If her husband makes them null and void on the day that he hears them, then whatever proceeds out of her lips concerning her vows or concerning her pledge of herself shall not stand. Her husband has made them void, and he who is will forgive her. Now that sounds like a repeat, but I don't think it is. I think it's actually a reference back again to widows and divorced wives, that if the vow preceded the death and the husband objected, or if the vow preceded the divorce and the husband objected, then the wife, even after the divorce, even after the death, is still not responsible to follow through with the vow. Now, if she finds herself newly divorced, newly widowed, and she wants to remake that vow because now she's the one that is accountable to God, then that is just the way that it's going to work. But if the husband objected, then it is not something she can be accountable for. Verse 13. Any vow and any binding oath to afflict her, her husband may establish or her husband may make void. But if her husband says nothing to her from day to day, then he establishes all her vows and all her pledges that are upon her. That's what I was saying a while ago. Silence is assent. If something is said by the wife as a vow and the husband heard it and doesn't react to it at all, he is in agreement with it, and it is therefore binding upon her. He has established them because he said nothing to her on the day that he heard of them. But if he makes them null and void after he's heard of them, then he shall bear her iniquity. So if it was a good vow that would have been perfectly appropriate for her to carry through, but he says, no, we're not doing that, he's accountable to God for stepping in and putting a stop to something that was good. Verse 16, these are the statutes that he who is commanded Moses about a wife, a man and his wife, and about a father and his daughter while she is in her youth within her father's house. Chapter 31. He who is spoke to Moses, saying, avenge the people of Israel on the Midianites. Afterward, you shall be gathered to your people. So as I said, we're getting closer and closer to the time when Moses will deliver his final address to the nation. That's the book of Deuteronomy. He's going to write all of that down. And then eventually he's going to say his goodbyes and go up onto Mount Pisgah at the beginning of the 11th month and pass away there and be buried there secretly by God. So he needs to take care of a little bit of business before that happens. And one of the things is to do something about the Midianites in particular that caused the trouble that led to the plague on those that were worshiping the gods and the goddesses of the Moabites and the Midianites and the Amalekites. Now, the Midianites are singled out here for some reason, and it would appear that they must have been among the greatest offenders of this effort to get the Israelis to bring God's wrath down upon them by getting drunk and getting involved in immoral, illicit sexual activities. So they're the ones that are being singled out here as receiving the judgment of God at the hands of the Israeli army. Verse 3, so Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm men from among you for the war, that they may go against Midian to execute he who is his vengeance on Midian. You shall send 1,000 from each of the tribes of Israel to war. So there were provided out of the thousands of Israel, 8,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. And Moses sent them to war, 1,000 from each tribe, together with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, with the vessels of the sanctuary and the trumpets of the alarm in his hand. So Phinehas is the one that actually executed the one Israeli that brought a Midianite woman back to the Israeli encampment near the tabernacle and was engaged in this illicit sexual liaison. And Phinehas was singled out as the hero in putting a stop to the plague at that time inside the encampment. So now he is given the responsibility to be the priest accompanying the 12,000 Israeli militia members that are going to go out and exact justice upon the Midianites who had sucked in these Israelis that are now dead into this immoral behavior. Verse 7, they warred against Midian, as he who is commanded Moses, and killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian with the rest of their slain, Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, the five kings of Midian. Now, the Midianites were a group of peoples affiliated together ethnically, and they probably had like five major cities within the region. And so that's why there's five kings here. We'll see something similar with the Philistines later. Now, look at the end of verse 8. And they also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. Remember I told you that when the scripture said earlier that he went back to his place, that it probably did not mean that he went back north to Aram, but rather he was just going back to his tent. And he offers advice to how to get the Israelis to misbehave in such a way that God will judge them. So all of that happened, and Balaam was still hanging out with the Midianites when the Israelis caught up with them. And he gets executed alongside them. And he is a prophet that started out good, that went bad, and ended up dying in sin. And so I have zero expectation, in my own opinion, that we will see Balaam in eternity, because he made the choice to abandon the truth and tried to curse Israel, and actually got God to curse them by the suggestions that he made to the Midianites and the Moabites. So verse number 9, the people of Israel took captive the women of Midian and their little ones, and they took as plunder all their cattle, their flocks, and all their goods, all their cities and the places where they lived, and all their encampments they burned with fire. And they took all the spoil and the plunder, both man and beast. And they brought the captives and the plunder and the spoil to Moses and to Eleazar the priest and the congregation of the people of Israel at the camp on the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. Now, I don't know how far away this execution party ranged, because Midian is actually located to the south and a little bit east of Moab. So it appears as if they did pass along the king's highway back down to the south side of Moab and carry out this execution. And then they bring all the booty, including these peoples, back to the camp at Israel to divide it up. Now Moses is not happy that they brought the women back that had been involved in the sinful behavior. Verse 14, Moses was angry with the officers of the army, the commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds who had come from service in the war. Moses said to them, "Have you let all the women live? Behold, these, on Balaam's advice, caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against he who is in the incident of Peor. And so the plague came upon the congregation of he who is." So Moses is like, why are these women here? These are the very ones that were engaged in the practices that brought the sin, which brought the judgment. Verse 17, now therefore kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known man by lying with him, but all the young girls who have not known man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. So they were allowed to keep the virgin girls for service, and possibly, we'll see this in the book of Deuteronomy, that as some of these Midianite girls grow up in service, they may end up being married to some of the younger Israelis, provided that these Midianite girls convert to the true faith. Verse number 19, in camp outside the camp 7 days, whoever of you has killed any person and whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves and your captives on the third day and on the seventh day. You shall purify every garment, every article of skin, all work of goat's hair, and every article of wood. Now, Moses is just basically saying, follow the rules. When you've touched a dead body, you're supposed to stay in the unclean encampment for a week. Anything that you've captured from a non-Israeli source needs to be put in isolation for a period of time and go through these ritual washings and such. So get that done. Verse number 21. Then Eleazar the priest said to the men in the army who had gone to battle, "This is the statute of the law that he who is has commanded Moses." And then it says, only the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that can stand the fire, you shall pass through the fire, and it shall be clean. So you've got isolation going on with the people and some of the garments and things, but now the metal objects are just heated. They might even be smelted and reformed into small pieces that are more easily managed. Nevertheless, it shall also be purified with the water for impurity. So the holy water that they have is also going to be put on this. And whatever cannot stand the fire, you shall pass through the water. You must wash your clothes on the seventh day, and you shall be clean. And then afterward, you may come into the camp. So, cleansing ceremony has to happen. He who is said to Moses, take the count of the plunder that was taken, both of man and beast, and Eleazar the priest and the heads of the father's household of the congregation, divide the plunder into two parts between the warriors who went out to battle and all the congregation. And levy for the Lord a tribute from the men of war who went out to battle, 1 out of 500 of the people and the oxen and the donkeys and of the flocks. So it's not a 10%, it's 1 of 500. Take it from their half and give it to Eleazar the priest as a contribution to he who is. And from the people of Israel's half, you shall draw 1 out of every 50 of the people, the oxen, the donkeys, the flocks, the cattle, and give them to the Levites who keep guard over the tabernacle of he who is. So you basically divide everything up into two halves, one for the warriors that went, the 12,000 guys, and then the rest of it goes to the congregation of the people of Israel. And then you take 1 of 500 from the warriors and 1 of 50 from the Israelis and give it to the Lord's service. So Moses and Eleazar the priest did as he who is commanded Moses. Now the plunder remained of the spoil that the army took was 675,000 sheep, 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, 32,000 persons in all, and women who had not known a man by lying with him. And then it starts telling you the numbers that are given from the warriors. And I'm because of the time, I'm not going to read those. You can check them yourselves. And then down toward the end of the chapter, so the officers who were over the armies, the commanders of hundreds, came near to Moses and said, "Your servants have counted the number of men in the war, and there's not one man missing. And we've brought the Lord's offering, what each man found." And so Moses and Eleazar the priest received from them the gold, all crafted articles, and these were contributed to the Lord, 16,750 shekels worth. And then they also received the people's offering. So that finishes the affair of the Midianites. And now Moses is going to start talking to the people about moving to the promised land.